Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. On behalf of the Wyoming Supreme Court's Children's Justice Project, I would like to welcome you to the CJP Monthly Training Series. The training is offered the second Thursday of every month from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. for key stakeholders involved in the Wyoming juvenile court system. We have a great training lined up for you today. To download the materials for today's training, please visit the CJP website at www.courts.state.wy.us/CJP and click on the training tab. If you have questions, please call in during the last 10 minutes of the training. The phone number is 917-889. Good afternoon. On behalf of the Wyoming Supreme Court's Children's Justice Project, I would like to welcome you to the CJP Monthly. Good afternoon. On behalf of the Wyoming Supreme Court's Children's Justice Project, I would like to welcome you to the CJP Monthly Training Series. The training is offered the second Thursday of every month from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. for key stakeholders involved in the Wyoming juvenile court system. We have a great training lined up for you today. To download the materials for today's training, please visit the CJP website at www.courts.state.wy.us/CJP and click on the training tab. If you have questions, please call in during the last 10 minutes of the training. The phone number is 917-889-8064. Again, that number is 917-889-8064. You may also post questions and comments using the chat session on the Blog Talk Radio website. After today's training, please go to the CJP webpage to complete a survey. We hope you find today's training beneficial.
Welcome to Blog Talk, everyone. I apologize for the restart. I'm not sure what happened there, but I think we're off and running. My name is Whitney Agopian, and I am the Children's Justice Project Coordinator. I'd like to thank you again for tuning in for this important blog talk today presented by Jill Kuchera, Senior Assistant Attorney General at the Wyoming Attorney General's Office, and Stacy Dunlay, Department of Family Services 4E Manager. Jill and Stacy are going to be discussing the Title 4E Foster Care Funds and giving an overview. They'll provide an overview of 4E, discuss required 4E findings for the Department of Family Services to receive federal reimbursement, and the upcoming 4E audit. Thanks, Jill and Stacy. I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, Whitney.
Take it away, like Whitney. Stacy.
Great. Like Whitney said, my name's Stacy Dunlay, and I work at the Department of Family Services. We wanted to talk a little bit about 4E. The 4E program is authorized by Title 4E of the Social Security Act and implemented under the Code of Federal Regulations, Parts 1355, 1356, and 1357. It is an annually appropriated program with specific eligibility requirements and fixed allowable uses of funds. Funding is awarded by formula. It's an open-ended entitlement grant and is contingent upon an approved 4E plan to administer and supervise administration of the program. The 4E agency, in this instance, it's the Department of Family Services, must submit yearly estimates of program expenditures as well as quarterly reports of estimated and actual program expenditures in support of the awarded funds. Only the public agency or tribe that's designated to provide a program of foster care is eligible to apply for and receive the direct 4E funding. Individuals or private entities may apply to the Title 4E agency as subgrantees or contracted providers. periodic and systematic reviews of the state Title IV-E foster care eligibility programs are conducted by the Children's Bureau to ensure federal funds are expended for intended purposes and to recover any improper expenditures. This is done through the Child and Family Services Review and through the Title IV-E Review. Our next Title IV-E Review is occurring in May. I think it's important to note that when we talk about these federal mandates for 4E, we're talking about 4E children. However, in practice, we don't differentiate the difference between a 4E child and a non-4E child to ensure that 4E protections are afforded to all of our children in foster care. So why is 4E so important, and why do you keep hearing so much about it? 4E provides a significant source of funding to help pay for supportive services for our staff, for training, for the most vulnerable children, those being children from low-income families who've been deprived of at least one parent. It's also an incentive for states to attend to the rights of parents and the permanency needs of those children. 4E dollars help provide partial reimbursement to 4E agencies to assist with foster care maintenance payments for 4E eligible children in foster care, adoption assistance payments for eligible children, administrative support to help manage programs, and training for staff, for foster parents, and for adoptive parents. It's also really important because children who are 4E are also which is especially important for children who might live out of state or who are later adopted. The next slide addresses some eligibility and reimbursability criteria. Children have to be eligible for AFDC under the July 16, 1996 Wyoming State Plan. They have to be removed from the home either through a voluntary placement agreement or the court. There have to be several judicial findings made initially and on an ongoing basis, and Joe will discuss that more later. But the judicial determinations, there's a couple surrounding reasonable efforts, and then another in regards to contrary to the welfare language or best interest language. The child must be placed in a fully licensed foster family home or in a child care institution. We'll talk more about these as we move through the presentation, but if these criteria are not met, a child will never be 4E eligible during that custody episode. The next slide contains the federal definition of foster care. The federal definition is pretty broad, but it does include more than foster homes. It could also include specialized foster care, therapeutic foster care, group homes, residential care. It's important to note that it doesn't include detention settings, hospitalizations, the Wyoming Boys School, the Wyoming Girls School. A child who's placed in one of those facilities may still be 4E eligible, but they wouldn't be reimbursable during those placements. However, if a child later moves into foster care or was in foster care prior to one of those placements, they could be reimbursable during those times. Also, I just want to point out, it does talk about substitute care for whom the state agency has placement and care responsibility, and we'll talk more about this in a minute and what that looks like. So I mentioned that the child has to be placed in a licensed foster home or child care facility. The child's placement must be fully licensed, including out-of-state placements, to be able to receive a 4E reimbursement. That includes criminal background checks, and checking of the central registry to make sure that there haven't been any substantiations for abuse or neglect of a child or vulnerable adult. It also includes fingerprinting and that there's a fingerprint-based criminal record check of NCIC and state criminal records. For out-of-state placements, we do obtain a copy of the license and letter from the state requiring from the state entity that states what their process is and how they meet the same licensing requirements. If the placement is not fully licensed and the child's placed there either in the interim or pending or they're provisional, that's not satisfactory. The child doesn't become reimbursable until they are fully certified. In those instances, the funds need to be paid with the use of state general funds. And again, fully licensed does mean all of the safety checks have been included, including the criminal background checks and fingerprints, prior to the provider's license being issued. The next slide talks about the AFDC eligibility. And like I mentioned earlier, it is based on the July 1996 guidelines that were in the Wyoming State Plan. A child must have lived with a specified relative and been judicially or voluntarily removed within the past 6 months. The removal home for the 4E eligibility determination is the household of the person from whom custody of the child was given to the state. When we talk about specified relative or caregiver relative, that could include biological parents, adoptive parents, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles. Any blood relative or half-blood relative would fit that specified relative, caretaker relative definition. There must have been deprivation. The child has to be deprived of parental support. That can occur a variety of ways, some of which could include death, the unemployment of the principal wage earner. One of the most important pieces is there is an income and asset test. The income limit is very low. Just for example, for a family of two, the net income with allowable disregards is $277. If shelter supplied, it's $585 if no shelter supplied. So it's very, very low to meet that income test. They must also be a Wyoming resident, and they must also be a U.S. citizen or legal permanent resident. The asset limit is $10,000. So again, 1996 to today makes this even lower, and sometimes this is a really hard piece of criteria to meet. Eligibility does end when the child turns 18 unless the child is a full-time student and expected to graduate prior to reaching the age of 19. And again, the placement for responsibility for placement and care of the child, the 4E agency gets placement of the child through a couple of ways, a voluntary placement agreement, through a voluntary relinquishment, or a judicial hearing. A child's removal from the home has to have been one of these to be eligible and responsible for the placement of the child. Jill, do you want to pick up there, or do you want me to keep going?
Can you go ahead and talk about the voluntary placement agreement, then I will take it from there.
Sure. Yes. So the voluntary placement agreement has a couple of really important pieces. It's a written agreement. It has to be dated. It has to be signed by the department. Usually it's signed by the district manager, and it also has to be signed by the parent or guardian. And sometimes we see them and they're not signed, and that's problematic. It can only be in effect for a limited amount of time, and then there needs to be some court action. By the 180-day, the court must make the contrary to the welfare finding, or in those cases, if there wasn't that finding, that child would no longer be eligible.
Okay, and there's one other way that a child can come into the department's custody, and this happens very rarely prior to the beginning of a juvenile neglect case, but a parent could relinquish the care and custody of their child to the department. However, if that occurs, we still need a court order that issues within 2 months of the placement. That includes the contrary to the welfare language, which I'll talk about in a bit, or the best interest finding. We can't have a court just merely validate the voluntary relinquishment of parental rights. And the 4E eligibility doesn't become effective until the first day of the month that the court makes the judicial findings that are necessary. So if a child is living with their parent within 6 months of the date that court proceedings were initiated, that removal through the relinquishment would be considered a judicial removal. But again, we still need to have those court findings. So mostly what we're going to talk about with the rest of the presentation is that juvenile court action that places the child in the 4E agency's custody or in the department's custody, and what those requirements are that would allow the state to get reimbursement for that child's placement in foster care, as well as those other dollar amounts that Stacy talked about earlier. So again, court orders, we have to have, and this is just an overview of what I'm going to talk about in the next few slides. The 4E agency has to have the custody and control of the child. There has to be a best interest or contrary to the welfare finding. There has to be a reasonable effort to prevent removal finding in a particular court order. And later on, once a permanency goal is established, there has to be a finding of reasonable efforts to finalize the permanency plan. It does have to be a valid removal of the child. We can only get into a 4E placement when there is an actual removal of the child from the home. Even if we have a court case where if the kids are left with the parents, we do not have a removal of the children from the home for 4E purposes. So the next few minutes, I'm going to talk about and focus on court order language, timeliness, and again, the specifically required language to make a case reimbursable for 4E. And as Stacy said a little bit earlier, there's a difference between being eligible for 4E and being reimbursable. I always say 4E has kind of three factors: the eligibility factor, the safety factor, which is making sure that foster home is fully licensed and all of those background checks have been done, and then the reimbursability factor, which fits into the court-ordered language. So a child can be eligible and never be reimbursable if some of the findings are not made at the beginning of the case. Now, when we talk about responsibility for placement and care, what that means is that the 4E agency has to be the entity that's responsible, that basically makes the determinations on where the child is going to be placed and be responsible for the care of the child. And so when we talk about court orders in that respect, we talk about whether or not the court order names the placement. The best language for that responsibility and care is that the child is placed in the legal and physical custody of the Department of Family Services for appropriate placement in foster care. If the court order does name the placement, in order for that case to continue to be reimbursable, there must be some language in the order that states that the Department of Family Services had input into the placement decision. And if the court order names a placement that is not the recommendation of the department, specific language in the court order as to why the department's recommendation was rejected. So if we don't have that language that we need, for example, say the court order says the child is placed with Aunt Susie and there's no information that DFS had input on that, the case may not be reimbursable until we have an appropriate court order that does give the department that responsibility for the placement and care of the child. So, again, some sample language is a minor child, Jimmy Jones, is placed in the custody of the Department of Family Services for appropriate placement in foster care. Some language that's not so good is that the minor child, Jimmy Jones, is placed in the home of his paternal aunt, Jessica Jones, and that's all it says. If we have that court order that just says that, that case is not going to be reimbursable until we have an appropriate court order. Okay, the first specific court finding is the contrary to the welfare or best interest finding. And again, that doesn't have to be those exact words. Words to that effect are still acceptable. Examples include the child's health and safety will be seriously endangered if not taken into custody, or is it against the child's best interest to remain in the home? This finding must be made in the first court order that sanctions, even temporarily, the removal of the child from the home. So typically that's going to be what we know of as a shelter care order at the beginning of a juvenile neglect case. But if you have a juvenile neglect case where at the beginning of the case the child remained in the home and sometime into the case there's a determination that the child needs to be removed from the home, then we're going to be looking for that contrary to the welfare language in that later court order. This is a finding that has to be made for the case to ever be reimbursable. If we do not have the contrary to the welfare finding in the first court order that sanctions removal of the child from the home, the case will never be reimbursable. We also can't go back and say, oh, we're going to do a non-pro-tunk order and throw that language in there. If during our federal audit the auditors see a non-pro-tunk order, they are going to say, no, that's not appropriate. The only way that we can determine if the language is not in the court order as to whether that finding was actually made is to actually get the transcript from the court hearing and determine if the judge actually made that finding from the bench. The finding must be made in both emergency and non-emergency removals. What happens when the agency is looking to see whether a 4E case is reimbursable is that they have 4E benefit specialists who will look at court orders to determine if that language is in the court order so that they can make the case reimbursable and get that reimbursement of the payment for the foster care. Again, it's the shelter care order is most often the first order of removal. We have 48 hours in our state statute that says when you have to hold a shelter care. That 48-hour time frame has nothing to do with 4E. That is just a requirement of our state statute. I caution that be careful to look at the language in the order, not just the name of the hearing. So don't just be looking for, oh, it says shelter care hearing. This must be the appropriate order. There could have been an ex parte order for protective custody before that shelter care hearing, and that ex parte order would have been the first order that sanctioned removal of the child from the home. And if that did happen, that ex parte order must contain the contrary to the welfare language. We often hear that 4E only applies in child protection cases, but that is not true, it can apply in delinquency and CHINS cases, and a child may be determined to be 4A eligible in delinquency and CHINS cases. And so, again, in those type of cases, in order for that case to be reimbursable, number one, child has to be placed in foster care, not in a detention facility, not in the Wyoming Boys School or Girls School. And there needs to be that contrary to the welfare finding in the order. If there's only a finding that it's contrary to the public interest that the child remain out of custody, meaning that the child is being placed in detention or custody to protect the public from the child, that language doesn't work for 4A purposes. It has to be contrary to the welfare of the child to be in the home or in the best interest of the child to be removed from the home. Again, just to reiterate, ideally, orders will read as follows. It is contrary to the welfare of the child to remain in the home, and it is in the best interest of the child to be placed in protective custody because, again, specific language as to why it's contrary to the welfare of the child to remain in the home. Some of the reasons might be that the child's health and safety would be seriously endangered if not taken into custody, that there are no parents in the home to care for the child, those kind of things. The second finding that is necessary, and again, this is a finding that if we don't have it in a court order, the case will never be able to be fully reimbursable, is the reasonable efforts to prevent removal language. And this differs from reasonable efforts to reunify. This is a finding that the court is making the determination that there were reasonable efforts made with the family to prevent the removal of the child from the home before protective custody was taken. This finding must be made within 60 days of the child's removal, and again, ideally, this finding would be made in the shelter care order or in that first order that sanctions removal, but if it's not in that first order, we have an additional period of time that the finding can be made, but if it's not made, again, the case will never be reimbursable. The finding should be detailed and child-specific, not just a reference to state law. Our federal regulations provide that our court order language needs to be precise, specific, detailed, and timely. We sometimes have ICWA cases, and you might see language that says active efforts were made to prevent removal. That's going to be totally appropriate to meet this finding for 4A purposes. Active efforts are something more than reasonable efforts, and so it's going to meet that requirement if we have that language. Again, there must be a judicial determination that reasonable efforts were made to prevent a child from being removed from the home. There is a situation where the court could make a finding that due to the emergency nature of the situation, that amounts to aggravated circumstances, the lack of reasonable efforts to prevent removal was reasonable. However, that can't be a finding that's made in every court order. Occasionally we'll see, well, it must be an emergency situation because there was protective custody taken. But there could have been reasonable efforts to prevent removal even given the fact that protective custody was taken. For example, the agency could have been involved with the family prior to the protective custody and had been making efforts to resolve some of the issues the family was having. There could have been a situation where there was an attempt to find an alternative placement other than removing the child from the home. For example, if a relative could have stepped in to take care of the child. So, again, I caution people on just saying, oh, well, it's always an emergency situation, so we don't need that reasonable efforts finding. we have had in the past in our audits certain jurisdictions making that emergency determination finding on a regular basis, and our federal partners have cautioned us and asked us to speak with those districts because, again, that is that exception to the reasonable efforts finding is something that should happen rarely, and again, not in all circumstances. Again, that finding needs to be made no later than 60 days from the date the child is removed from the home, or the case will be forever ineligible for FORI purposes. An example of some good language is that it is neither appropriate nor in the best interest of the child for the child to remain in the child's home. This finding was made with the knowledge that reasonable efforts were made to prevent removal of the child from the home. And then the emergency language, a good example of that is that reasonable efforts to prevent removal were not necessary in this case due to the following emergency circumstances. The parents were arrested and there were no other appropriate persons to provide care for the minor. Remember, it's a case-by-case determination for the emergency situation. Some other examples: the house caught on fire and there was no home for the children to go to. The child was in imminent danger and the parents could not be located. Those kind of things could qualify for those emergency circumstances. But again, you need to look and see if the department had been working with that family prior to the removal, because that could fit in as those reasonable efforts to prevent removal. The final finding is the finding of reasonable efforts to finalize the permanency plan. This finding needs to be made within 12 months of the date the child is placed into foster care, and then it needs to continue to be made not less frequently than every 12 months thereafter if the child remains in foster care. And it is reasonable efforts have been made to finalize the permanency plan. Those reasonable efforts need to be, the language needs to be that reasonable efforts were made by the FORI agency. So reasonable efforts were made by the Department of Family Services to finalize the permanency plan. And of course, we have various things that could be included as a permanency plan. Reunification is the first and foremost permanency plan that should be attempted in these cases. Next is adoption, not termination of parental rights. Termination of parental rights is not a permanency plan. It is a means to effectuate the permanency plan of adoption. Guardianship, and then another plan, permanent living arrangement, or APLA or OPLA, you sometimes hear that. That finding requires documentation of compelling reason as to why you're going to that particular plan in the case plan. So any judicial determination that names the permanency goal and finds that the Department of Family Services made reasonable efforts to finalize the permanency goal meets this requirement, and once that finding is made, the 12-month time frame is reset. So the findings don't have to be made on anniversary dates, but must be made within 12 months of the previous finding. So, for example, if the child comes into foster care in January of 2018, January 15th of 2018, then there needs to be a finding that reasonable efforts were made to finalize the permanency plan by January 15th of 2019. It can be made before that. Let's say there's a permanency hearing that happens in December of 2018 that has the appropriate language. We're going to use that for FORI purposes and then reset that 12-month time frame. if we do not have some examples of language relating to this reasonable effort finding are the permanency plan for the minor is reunification of the minor with her mother, and the Department of Family Services has made reasonable efforts to finalize those plans. Or the Department of Family Services has been and is making reasonable efforts towards the permanency goal of adoption. Another example is the permanency goal was reunification. The Department of Family Services has made reasonable efforts toward that goal, but those efforts are no longer required and the permanency goal is now changed to adoption. Again, that particular finding would reference the fact that reasonable efforts were made towards the permanency goal as it was until the hearing occurred, then the goal changed. This is one of those findings that if the finding is not made in a timely fashion, the case becomes unreimbursable, but we can make the case reimbursable again by having that finding in a later order. So the 4E reimbursability may be reinstated on the first day of the month in which the required judicial determination is made. So again, for my example, if the finding was due on January 15th, 2019, but it wasn't actually made until April 15th of 2019, the case would be unreimbursable beginning in February, because the finding wasn't due till the middle of January. So it'd be unreimbursable for February and March, but the case would be reimbursable on April 1st, because the finding was made in the month of April. And I hope that's clear as mud. Eligibility is based on the 1 day, 1 month rule, and that's what I'm talking about. We have eligibility for the full month in which the finding was supposed to be made, and we have eligibility and reimbursability for the full month in the month in which the finding was finally made. We can have trial home placements in 4E cases, but those trial home placements cannot exceed 6 months in duration, unless the court, before the end of that six-month time frame, orders a longer time frame. And we need specific language in the court order that says the court is extending the trial home placement. If the trial home placement goes beyond 6 months without authorization by the court and the child returns to foster care at some point in time down the road, that is a new placement episode, and we have to determine 4E eligibility and reimbursability all over again, even though the juvenile case reflecting the child might not have ended. And so if that happens, let's say the child was in a trial home placement for 7 months, came back into foster care, there was no court order to extend that time frame, then we're going to need the contrary to the welfare and the reasonable efforts to prevent removal language in court orders again in order to make that case 4E eligible and reimbursable. So in summary, we have to have the contrary to the welfare or best interest language in the first order that sanctions removal, even temporarily. We need to have the reasonable efforts to prevent removal finding within that first order or within 60 days from the date of the actual removal of the child from the home. And finally, we need the reasonable efforts to finalize the permanency plan language within 12 months of the child's removal from the home and at least every 12 months thereafter. There have been some, I'm going to say recent legislation, it's actually been out there for about a year now, but that is going to make some changes to some of the requirements for 4E, and I'm going to let Stacy talk about that just a little bit.
Sure. So the Family First Prevention Services Act, like Bill mentioned, it's been about a year. It was signed into law back in February of 2018. Some parts of the law were effective immediately, and the department implemented those. Some of them are effective in the future, and so we as an agency have a lot of work to do and collaboration with stakeholders to do to make those things happen. One of the most important things about Family First is in regards to prevention. It's really promoting and supporting prevention efforts to keep children and families together and decrease the need for out-of-home placements. And one of the ways they're doing that is by providing financial support for preventative services. So the federal government's still working on providing us with some guidance. And Wyoming has asked for a delayed implementation of no later than September of 2021 to implement a 4E prevention program. But eventually, prevention funding will be available to the department through a reimbursement process for certain evidence-based and trauma-informed programs for both parents and kids. The support will be available to a child whose adoption or guardianship arrangement is at risk of disruption that could potentially result in a foster care placement. So, like I said, we're working on that, and they do have to be evidence-based and trauma-informed programs. And we also will be working on setting up a way to claim reimbursement and draw down that federal reimbursement in the same way we do for the Title IV-E foster care program.
So just a little bit of additional things about 4E. All of these findings that we've talked about have actually been placed in our Wyoming statute. So we're not just saying, oh, we have these federal requirements that we need in order to get these state dollars. They are actually required findings pursuant to our state statutes as well. The reason for all of these findings is, of course, best practices for children and families that come into care. Again, the 4E dollars are kind of the carrot to make states comply with these requirements in the best interest of children and families. And we are talking about if a finding is not made in a particular case, it can lead to the loss of significant amounts of dollars for the state. For example, if we have a child in a institutional placement, for example, in an RTC, which would meet the definition of foster care, and that payment for that placement is, let's say, $5,000 a month, and we don't have the reasonable efforts to finalize the permanency plan language made, let's say, for approximately 5 months. The state is going to lose, so that the cost of that placement would be $25,000. The state could lose approximately half of that amount, and correct me if I'm wrong, Stacy, but so approximately $12,000 $500 just for that one particular placement. If, for example, that type of placement was happening and we didn't have the 4E findings made at the beginning of the case and the child remained in placement for a year or 2 years, you can imagine the amount of dollars that the state is not able to recoup to provide for those children and those families. So these findings are important for a number of reasons. One, they're required by state law. Two, they're in the best interest of children and families. And three, the money that we lose could go to help those children and families. Do you have anything to add to that, Stacy?
Nope, I don't think so. And I said at the beginning that although some of these specific things are in regards to 4E, it really is about supporting all of the kids and affording them with the same opportunities and urgency that all of our kids should have and deserve. And as we go, as we move forward with Family First, the same thing being the case, there are funds associated with things, and that's really a benefit to us and our kids and families. But we do want to make sure that we're providing opportunities to all of our kids, whether they would be eligible for that funding or not.
And Stacy mentioned that the state is going to undergo a FORE audit in May of this year. The state undergoes a FORE audit every 3 years. When that happens, our federal partners come in, and there's a state and federal team of auditors that review approximately 80 files. They take a percentage of the 40 files, and they review them looking to see whether all of those requirements have been met. The financial part, was eligibility appropriately established? The safety part, is the foster home fully licensed? And have all of the background checks and things been done? And then the court order part, do we have the appropriate language in the court orders on these particular cases? The state can have up to 4 error cases. Is that right, Stacy?
Yep, 4 or fewer cases.
And if they have more than that, then the state is put under what is called a program improvement plan. And also on those error cases, they do have to pay back the money that was inappropriately received by the state, given those cases where there was a determination that there was an error. If they are put under a program improvement plan and they are not able to complete that plan, then they could face the possibility of having to pay back a much greater percentage of dollars to the Fed. So these things are very important for the children and families in our state. And Wyoming has been pretty good about passing the audit the last several times, but they do an extensive pre-audit to look at cases and determine problems. So for you around the state, if you get contacted by your by somebody from my office or by a DFS worker saying, you know, we're the language in our court orders is just a little bit problematic, the reason for that is that the state agency is constantly reviewing these files to, you know, try and make them better, try and get our court orders to be the best that they can be. And with that, unless, Stacy, you have anything else to add, I think our presentation is done.
Thank you both for such a fantastic presentation. We will be uploading the slides to the CJP website that Jill and Stacy referenced today during the presentation. Just a reminder that we're going to be having a special blog talk on the Central Registry on April 17th. So please tune in and mark your calendar. And remember to register for the 2019 symposium in Cheyenne at Little America, June 25th through the 27th. Thank you again for your presentation today, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you.